Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 31st of August, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk to Divas Eve Dillingham and Alaska Cicada as they get ready for the Hoosier Diva event next month. Ellen Carley from the Alaska State Museum will be here with Scott Carley here to talk about their science gun demonstrations on Friday and Saturday. We'll also talk with artists involved in the City Museum's Metamorphosis show. And stone sculptor Bob Konitzer will be here to invite us to his first Friday reception at the Juneau Artist Gallery. That writer's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like rain developing in the evening with rain possibly heavy at times later on. Low temperatures around 48 degrees. Rain tomorrow morning and rain in the afternoon tomorrow.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Wildfires on the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation are scorching land and threatening housing. KWSO's Will Robbins has more.
About 40 residents of the Sidwalter subdivision on the reservation remained on evacuation alert Wednesday after engine task forces fought off of the wind-driven power line fire late Tuesday afternoon. Tom Lavanino is the fire information officer for the Oregon, California Type 2 interagency management team.
They had their time with the wind in the afternoon. As you know, the temperatures were high and the humidity is low at that point, and the wind was high. So all three of those events came together and pushed that fire to the south, to the east, and kind of threatened or challenged some of the houses. So there's some good firefighting done by the troops and protecting of all the houses in that area.
Highway 26 through the reservation remains closed, as is a 26-mile stretch of the Deschutes River. To the north, on Mount Hood, firefighters are wrapping the historic cloud cap in with fire-resistant material to protect it from the Dollar Lake fire, which has now grown to 1,500 acres. Fire on the Warm Springs Reservation has so far consumed over 70,000 acres and is only 10% contained. For National Native News, I'm William Robbins in Warm Springs, Oregon.
Native veterans' issues were addressed during a hearing in Rapid City Tuesday held by South Dakota U.S. Senator Tim Johnson with Indian Health Service and Department of Veterans Affairs officials. Johnson says federal agencies need to do a better job serving Native American veterans. Charles Michael Ray has more.
Don Loudner is a Korean War vet from the Crow Creek Reservation who's also head of the National American Indian Veterans Association. Loudner expresses frustration that Native vets are often juggled between the IHS and the VA when they need health care. He says some are forced to drive hundreds of miles to a VA hospital for care rather than receiving it at an IHS facility close to home.
In order for this to all work, we need to work as a team like we did when we were in the service. You know, if everybody didn't do their job, we'd have been beat a long time ago.
Loudner praises Senator Johnson's efforts, but he says that a memorandum of understanding signed between the VA and the IHS last year hasn't helped remedy the problem. The VA recently created a new office of outreach to tribes. IHS officials testified they're working to improve coordination, but they refused to comment to the press. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
First Nations leaders from Canada are planning to join the protest in front of the White House against a proposed oil pipeline. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, they'll take part in an Indigenous Day of Action Friday.
The proposed Keystone Pipeline would cross six states and include Native territories. Activists have gathered in front of the White House for more than a week to protest against the pipeline. More than 250 of them have been arrested. The pipeline would carry about 900,000 barrels of oil a day from Alberta to the Gulf Coast refineries, and supporters say it would create thousands of jobs and help end American reliance on Middle East oil. But opponents claim it would encourage more oil production from the Alberta oil sands, described as the dirtiest oil in the world because of the greenhouse gases produced by extracting the oil. Now many First Nations leaders in Canada are joining with their counterparts in the U.S. for a day of action, among them George Poitras, a former chief of the Mikisew Cree in northern Alberta.
We would like President Obama to hear our pleas. Perhaps he will not approve this pipeline. We're concerned because we feel that there is a link between many of the unusual health issues and cancers.
Other Native leaders fear the impact that increased production from the oil sands would have on their communities in the Northwest Territories. Environmental activists say one barrel of oil from the oil sands produces three times as much greenhouse gas as a barrel of oil from conventional methods. They say building the pipeline would be the same as adding about 6.5 million automobiles to the road. Native leaders are calling for a moratorium on expanding oil sands development and a stop to the Keystone Pipeline. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
During this week in 2010, Ken Wyatt was elected as the Liberal representative for the seat of Hasluck in Western Australia. He made history becoming the first Indigenous person to be elected to the House of Representatives. Indigenous Australians have served as senators in the Upper House of Parliament. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Coming up next September 10th, there's going to be a dynamic contest in town pitting 10 women against themselves to see who could be the best diva in Juneau. In the studio with us now are Alaska's Kid and Eve Dillingham, two of the contestants. I'd like to welcome them to the station. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
So I'm asking everybody the same questions, and so you can have your take at them here. First, we'll ask Alaska's Kid, what to you is a diva?
To me, a diva is someone who does singing for like a living and someone who enjoys singing a lot. Most people, when they think of a diva, they think of somebody stealing the spotlight and somebody always getting into cat fights and with other singers and stuff like that. But really, it's we kind of really get along and just really have a good time singing. But there are moments where we like to steal the spotlight.
Yeah. Eve, what to you is a diva?
The traditional kind of connotation of a diva is someone who's very much into themselves and has very high expectations and tries to put on a real show and steal the show. And I think for Who's Your Diva, that's the whole point, is to make sure that all of the women are going to feel like they are it and will put it out for you in a most extravagant manner so that that you are gravitating or magnetized towards choosing that as your diva.
When did you discover you were a diva and not just an ordinary mortal singer?
I suppose I discovered I was a diva when someone asked me to join Jazz Divas, which is a small band that plays every now and then down at TK McGuire's and is accompanied by Tom Loker and usually either Clay Good or Dave Sheakley on drums. So I think that was the first time I sort of considered myself, I guess, people on the street were calling me a diva, so that was my first realization.
Kit?
When I was little, my parents and my family always called me a little diva because I always wanted the spotlight being an only child, and I loved to sing, and so they called me a little diva. And as I got older, I got out of that mindset because I did choir with the Alaska Youth Choir, and I got into the working with the group and not stealing spotlight and blending in. And then also I really decided that I guess I was a diva when Tom Loker singled me out and asked me to be a part of Jazz Divas, and that's been really fun, and I've met a lot of other great divas just like Eve.
Kit, what does singing do for you emotionally and spiritually?
Singing for me emotionally and spiritually, music is everything to me. I base my entire life around music. For me, it's in everything I do. I memorize things with lyrics of songs and musical ditties, memorizing that way. And I learn better when I have music going on. Music is everything to me, and it helps me think so much better, and it just really gives me a sense of what I am, and I don't think I'd be the person that I quite am without music.
Eve?
Music's been a part of my life all of my life. I think as far as singing is concerned and what it does for me spiritually and emotionally is it removes me from some sorts of temporal things that are going on, and exposes me to a more ethereal experience than I might otherwise have. It's something to focus on. It's something that takes you into a Zen realm. It's fun to do it with other people because you're sharing harmonics with them and creating new soundscapes with them. So it's a large part of my life. I'd say just as Alaska's Kit mentioned, it becomes a part of your life.
Eve, what singers do you look up to and why?
Oh, geez, there are a ton of them, and the list would tend to increase. Tony Bennett, Manhattan Transfer Group, all of those folks. The realm of country music, I'd say Jim Reeves. If I were to get into opera, it might be Kathleen Battle. The list could go on and on.
And why?
I'm not stuck with one genre, to be quite frank. I appreciate all sorts of different ways of singing. And so it's hard. I admire all of them, and I try to take a piece from every kind of genre that I'm exposed to.
Good.
I admire every singer who gets up on the stage and has the guts to perform, but in the sense for my inspiration for my singing style, I'd have to say Frank Sinatra and Barbra Streisand and Celine Dion. They have a lot of power, and they have a lot of good breath control, and just having all that really pulls them apart from most singers. And so I like to be sort of like them, having my own style mixed in with that. But that's really the people I look up to. And then also just local singers like Kari Gruvin. I remember growing up when I first met her, and she was like my total idol, and I was like, oh, and everything. And also Eve, I thought was really, really cool. And there's a lot of local singers around this town that I've always looked up to, like also Vicky Van Fleet. I mean, all these wonderful divas. I'm just so very, very glad that I'm now kind of a part of that group, but I still feel that they are way above me.
Kid, what do you do to keep your voice in shape?
What do I do to keep my voice in shape? A lot of people say scales all the time. I do those about a couple times a day. But mostly it is I'm a part of choirs. Like, I'm a part of my chamber singers, school group choir at Thunder Mountain right now. And any song that I listen to and that I like, I will listen to over and over until I can walk away from the song and actually sing it in my head. And I think just because I'm singing so much, because I love music, that's how I keep my voice in shape.
Eve?
Well, you know, Jeff, the vocal instrument is it's a part of your body. And just like an athlete, if you really want to keep it in shape, you sort of have to continually work it a bit. So you can do exactly what Alaska's Kit mentioned, and that is to just continue to involve yourself in singing opportunities, which cause you to continue to use it and use those muscles. I also have a voice teacher, and he works with me individually to find out what sorts of areas in my voice I need work on, and I'll go home and take those particular exercises that are designed for me, and I'll work with those. And then I'll go in and I'll start to practice different genres, anything from opera to jazz to blues to country, as I mentioned before, and just work all sorts of realms from the upper register to the lower register to make sure that it stays in shape.
What songs will you be singing and why did you pick them?
Well, I've sort of decided to keep mine a surprise until the event. I'll give a little bit of hint about them. One of them, the lyrics were written by Johnny Mercer, who's a very famous lyricist from the last 20th century, mostly the early to mid 20th century. And the other tune is also from that era. So they're not going to be from the pop or rock era, but they will be a Latin swing kind of and jazz genre. And they both have a bit of a story to them. They are kind of written for a diva character. I get to, I have some choreography with both of them. So I'm hoping that people will come to actually see what they are and hear them.
Kit, what songs will you be singing and why did you pick them?
The one song that most people have heard me do around town is one of the songs I've picked, At Last, Made Famous by Etta James. I really just like that song because she has so much power when she sings it and so much passion. And it can be interpreted in so many different ways, and it connects with an audience so well that I just really enjoy singing it, and it's my favorite song, and it's so easy to play with vocally, so I just enjoy singing that. And then also my first song that I will be doing is called Midnight Sun. Mike Moss, who is the pianist, guitarist, I don't know how many instruments he's playing on this deal with other divas, but he wrote it originally, and this is the second song he's wrote for me. And the words are very something that really connect with me, and I hope really connect with the audience. But I thought it was very appropriate to pick that song for this event, since he is the person who is working very closely with us divas on the music.
Kid, who are your accompanists?
My accompanists... For this particular production, it is Mike Moss on the piano, Simon Taylor on the bass, and Dale McFarlane on the drums. I've worked with them before, and they are great guys. I enjoy working with them. And I'm hoping to have a special guest be playing with me on At Last, but that is not quite confirmed yet. But you'll have to come to the event to see who my special guest is.
Eve?
So all of the divas pretty much are using Mike Moss as the pianist and the Simon Taylor on bass and Dale McFarlane on drums. And some of us have added some musicians. And I've added John Haywood on alto sax and Luke Fortier on trombone on one of my songs. And then John Haywood will join me again on the second tune that I do.
I'm talking to two of the 10 divas that are going to be performing at the Who's Your Diva event on Saturday, September 10th at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. My last question is, what do you hope will set you apart from the other divas, Eve?
Probably the kinds of music that I choose and the way I present the tunes. I hope will... help the audience to reach deep into their pockets and come up and donate to the cause itself, which is the Juno Lyric Opera, which will help to fund some productions this year. They always put on wonderful musical theater productions as well as opera productions. So what I'm putting out, I think, will be just a little bit different than my other 9 colleagues on the stage. And that's what I hope will set me apart and allow folks to really contribute to the great cause that this is funding.
I think what sets me apart is the fact that I am the youngest diva of this event, and also I have a lot of power and a lot of passion within my music to give. And I think that's what sets me apart. Each of us is trying very hard to raise money for this event because Juno Lyric Opera is a great organization, and there are so many wonderful organizations that have been donating to the Juno Lyric Opera, like Shoefly, you know, helping us out with our shoes. But I think those are the only two things that really set me apart from the other divas.
I've been talking to Alaska's Kit and also Eve Dillingham about the Who's Your Diva event going on Saturday, September 10th at the Juno Arts and Culture Center. So from what I understand, the way that people are going to be judged is by how much money they could pull in, but from the admiring fans. So go there to the event and get your tickets in advance if they don't sell out early. So get them early, I think, as soon as you can. I'd like to thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff. And I would also like to mention some of the other folks who are sponsors. Aside from Shoefly, we have Sean O'Sullivan Photography, First Impressions Hair Salon, the Alaska Brewing Company. We have Chilcat Cones. We have Creativation. I understand that the event will have hors d'oeuvres and a bar and some chocolates, and it's just going to be a terrific event. So I hope that a lot of people quickly, because the tickets are running out, go and purchase their entrance fee for this great event.
And you can get them online by going to JunoLyric.org. Thank you for coming down to the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 31st of August, 2011. It's the anniversary of the death of the novelist and poet and automatic writer Elsa Barker in 1954, best known for her trilogy Letters from a Living Dead Man, a book of the occult which she said had been dictated to her by a man named X, whom she never saw and never met. It's the 64th birthday of manga artist Yumiko Oshima, born 1947 in the Tochigi Prefecture of Japan, a member of the Year 24 Flower Group, a group of women who have revolutionized shoujo manga, comic books for girls, bringing to these comic books issues of philosophy and sexuality and gender. The first major entry of women artists into comics in Japan. Her titles include Paula's Tears, To Joker, Strawberry Story, The Star of Cottonland, which has been collected in 7 volumes. It's the birthday of Eldridge Cleaver, born in Wabasica, Arkansas in 1935. Family moved to California to the Watts section of Los Angeles. As a boy, he started getting into trouble with the law, petty theft, selling marijuana, sent to reform school once for stealing a bike, got out, was arrested for drug possession. He was sent off to Soledad Prison, where he discovered the works of Lenin, Karl Marx, Tom Paine. 1957, Eldridge Cleaver was arrested for rape, convicted of assault with intent to murder, ended up in San Quentin, then in Folsom Prison. Began reading books by Malcolm X, started writing his own essays, which were collected in his famous book Soul on Ice, published in 1968. Got out of jail, helped to found the Black Panthers. He got in a shootout between the Panthers and the police, was charged with attempted murder, and he jumped bail, fled the U.S., lived as an exile in Algeria, Cuba, and France, came back to this country in 1975, renounced the Black Panthers, gave himself up to the authorities. The charges against him were dropped. He became a born-again Christian, ran for the Republican Senate seat in the state of California, wrote a second book, Soul on Fire. By the early 80s, he was disillusioned with evangelical Christianity and converted to Mormonism. He was baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1983. By the mid-80s, he was addicted to crack cocaine, was arrested for burglary several times, possession of cocaine, got clean, went to work as a diversity counselor at the University of Laverne near Los Angeles, and gave a speech in 1998 saying he'd gone beyond civil rights and human rights to creation rights, and the idea that God had made all of us first class and provided this earth as our home for all of us. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston, entitled September. It rained in my sleep, and in the morning the fields were wet. I dreamed of artillery, of the thunder of horses. In the morning the fields were strewn with twigs and leaves, as if after a battle or a sudden journey. I went to sleep in summer. I dreamed of rain. In the morning the fields were wet, and it was autumn. September by Linda Paston, from Carnival Evening, published by W.W. Norton & Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, where your mobile device can turn into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app. You can find it online at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith, written by Priscilla Kinter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:26, and you are attuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Scott Carley and Ellen Carley from the Alaska State Museum. Scott is the curator of museum services, and Ellen is the Alaska State Museum conservator. We're talking here today about things going on at the museum on this Friday, including the Science Gun. First of all, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Thanks, Jeff.
So the Science Gun, what exactly is that?
Well, it's a portable, handheld Bruker X-ray fluorescence device for elemental analysis, which means it's this neat little gun that shoots a narrow beam of X-rays to tell you what elements your material is made out of.
Can you be a little bit more specific about how it works?
Sure. So it shoots an X-ray at your artifact, and it doesn't damage it. It just knocks some electrons out of their orbitals. Maybe you remember from science classes, you've got your nucleus of your atom, and then all the electrons are flying around it, like in orbitals, like planets around the sun, and it knocks those out of their spot, and another one will fall down into its spot and release some energy, and that energy is kind of like a fingerprint for the element. And so you can tell, if is it made out of gold, is it made out of copper, aluminum, like these kinds of elements. And if you know what your artifact might be expected to be made out of, you can see if that's what you've got in terms of the elements.
Is it an expensive tool?
It is an expensive tool. I think new, they're around $50,000.
Yeah, about $50,000, yeah.
Yeah, so there's probably 40 museums around the country that have these, and the company, Bruker, had sent up a representative with one of these science guns to the Pratt Museum in Homer, where Scott had an opportunity to take a class with him. And then it's on loan to us for a couple weeks, and next week we have to send it on to the Anchorage Museum. So it's kind of like test driving a car, and we thought it'd be fun to have the public be able to get in the fun a little bit.
What kind of things do museums use it for typically?
The big thing in museums right now is to test for pesticides, because a lot of pesticides have heavy metals in them, like arsenic and mercury, and you can really find those on museum artifacts with this device. The tricky thing is it's harder to know if you have an amount on your artifact that's dangerous to people, and how dangerous is it, and then the whole question of how do you get that off of your artifact is really controversial. So it's a big hot button museum issue right now.
Yeah, and what I wanted to say is too is that it used to be standard practice up into the 50s to put pesticide on artifacts to protect them from insects, but we don't do that anymore. But we still have this legacy sometimes, and it especially is prevalent on materials that are repatriated. So Native Alaskan or Native American materials can sometimes have these pesticide residues on them. So it's a good idea to know that before it maybe goes back into the community.
It all sounds very scientific. Is it dangerous?
Well, they are X-rays, so it is radiation, and you have to be careful with it. The interesting thing is, in Canada, you have to be certified to use one of these, but the United States doesn't have those restrictions. It's not as much radiation as we get at the doctor's office, and the really careful guidelines they send around with the gadgets, they keep people about a meter away from it. So I think at our event, we're going to keep people like 2 meters away from it and use all the safety precautions that the device has.
Yeah, it's very directional where the beam of X-ray is going, and so we know exactly where that is. It's not just being scattered out into the room. So,
And depending on the handheld device, the beam is between 2 and 5 millimeters wide. It's a very teeny beam. So it is radiation. It is worth taking seriously, but with the right precautions, it's not a dangerous item.
What does the final output look like? Is it a printed report or is it a picture that you could look at?
Well, what we do is look at it on a computer screen as a series of peaks. So if there's a line along the bottom and a line going up like a graph, it makes these peaks that look kind of like an electrocardiogram, like a heartbeat sort of thing. And where the peak goes is which element you have, and how high the peak goes is how much of it you have. So we get it as a graph on the computer monitor.
And tell me about what's going on this Friday and Saturday with the public.
Well, we've invited the public to bring in a metal item to put on the science gun and see if they can...
like a ring or a piece of jewelry or a coin or something that they're interested in. The instrument works best with heavier elements, and that's the easiest to detect. So Ellen and I aren't fully up to speed on this machine to get the nuances for lighter mass elements. So we'll be able to tell people whether it's gold and what percentage of gold it is, for example, and we'll be able to tell whether something is, you know, silver or not or something like that. So that's why we're encouraging people to bring a metal item. They're easier to analyze.
How long does the process take?
30 seconds to do it, really. I mean, you can set the machine to analyze for however long you want, but usually you can get good results almost instantaneously.
This is happening first Friday and also Saturday. What are the hours of the demonstrations?
Helen knows.
Yeah, on Friday it starts at about 4:30 in conjunction with the First Friday events, and we'll be looking at items until about 6 o'clock, and then again on Saturday from 1 to 3. But, of course, we've got that really great talk by Dick Wood also on First Friday, which starts at 5:30. So if you want to catch Dick Wood talking about historic photographs, you definitely want to bring your metal item in earlier than that so you can catch Dick Wood, too.
It's all happening at the Alaska State Museum, and it's all free.
All free.
It's all free. Free entry. And then you can sneak off and see the museum.
What a deal. I just wonder, you say the beam is only a couple of millimeters wide. How far would it travel?
Well, when it hits something, so if we have something on the detector that covers the detector completely, it doesn't go past the item. It's just if there's nothing covering the detector, then it goes off, you know, pretty far until it hits something, basically. So it's like a beam of an X-ray. It would go until it hits something. But we also have, for smaller items, we have a cover for it so that we put that over it so there's no X-rays that get out.
Sounds like one of those movies they've been showing at the planetarium recently.
What's that?
Science fiction films.
Oh, yeah.
And it definitely looks like a gun from Star Trek or something. It's a really fun-looking gadget, so that's got a little excitement and cachet, too.
I've been talking with Scott Carley and Ellen Carley from the Alaska State Museum about their demonstrations of the science gun happening Friday and Saturday at the Alaska State Museum. If you need more information about it, you can call them at 465-2901. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No, I think you covered it.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Thank you for coming by.
Sure.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh, yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots. Lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust. Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Mother Superior jumped the gun.
time is 3:36, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are from the Alaska City, Juneau Douglas City Museum, talking about a metamorphosis exhibit coming up on First Friday. Amanda Chisholm and one of the artists, Juneau Panella. Juneau Panella, thank you very much for coming down to the station, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
So you want to describe the show, if you could please, Amanda?
Sure. So we're lucky enough to have four great local jewelers, Rebecca Bush, Amy Fletcher, Deb Gregoire, and, of course, Juneau Panella, coming to the museum to have a showcase of the jewelry that they've made. And that's going to be this Friday. It's going to be more of like a solo artist showcase rather than... but it'll be displayed in the gift shop. So,
Juneau, can you talk a little bit about your style of work?
Well, I have been experimenting for many years now, but I do a lot of soldering. I use silver, this type of metal called new gold, a little bit of gold, but it's culturally expensive right now. I do a cold fusion, which is riveting, a lot of hammering. I like mixed media, so I experiment a lot.
What about working with metal fascinates you?
Well, kind of what the name of our show being Metamorphosis. I like starting with an idea and a piece, and you kind of have a plan, and then it sort of takes on a shape and a mind of its own and turns out completely different than you had thought, but it's still really fun. And just hammering and working intimately with metal is really fun, actually.
So, what kind of tools do you use?
I use a saw, hammer. I have a butane fire that I use for soldering. Yeah. So, and then just wire, lots of mixed media things.
Anna, could you describe the other artist's work?
You bet. Lots of, I would say, organic forms, and maybe Juneau, feel free to hop in anytime. Just, yeah, really beautiful metal, lots of leaf shapes, and I know Amy does more.
She uses metal, but she also does beading, really fine beading on leather, does a lot of bracelet cuffs, just beautiful work, very, very intricate designs.
Anything that ties it all together, other than that it's all metal?
Well, you know, what ties us together is, and the reason we decided to do the show is that we've been friends in different capacities, but we all started taking classes at the Canvas, and Rowan Law, who was teaching there, we had all taken his classes and got to know each other better there. And then there's a studio now at the Canvas for jewelers, and you can come in. It's different. I think now it's like maybe every other Wednesday night. And so just getting to know each other better in that capacity, we were already friends, but just getting to know each other as jewelers and supporting each other and encouraging each other, and just I think that's what moved us into wanting to do a show together.
I want to talk a little bit about how cool it is to work with a substance like a small jewelry that you have to get up close and personal. It's also wearable art.
Yeah. It is wearable art. And that's, you know, I think the mixed media part is bringing in, you know, different materials and turning it into art.
How do you design a piece?
That's a good question. Well, I think we're each influenced, and not to speak for the others, but influenced in different ways. And I think we all might say that we see art all around us. I know Deb is influenced a lot by nature, and Amy and Becca probably too. And I am as well, although I really love looking at books. I'm influenced by other artists. Michael Hunter is somebody I've taken classes with. Patty McDonald is a jeweler I really like. So I think you get influenced by those different pieces, and then it bleeds into your work. So,
about how many pieces are in the show itself?
I'd say about 90, hopefully.
We're hoping for, yeah, 90, yeah, 80 to 90.
So it'll be pretty full, lots to choose from.
Is it difficult working that small?
Well, my pieces range in size. No, I mean, things sometimes, when you're trying to do something really specific, it doesn't always go the way you plan, and it might melt. You might have to start over. So that part's difficult. But I think, I don't think that's an issue so much, the size. They're all different sizes. So, and some, like Deb's I would say, and Becca, like big earrings, I like smaller earrings. You know, we do different sizes. And Amy's cuffs are, you know, I think they're bigger size in terms of taking time to do the beading.
I've been talking to Gino Fontanella and also Amanda Chisholm from this Gino Douglas City Museum about their show Metamorphosis coming up this first Friday, featuring Rebecca Bush, Amy Fletcher, Deb Gregar, and also Jenna O'Fontanella. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Just make sure to come by the Juno Douglas City Museum Friday. It's going to be from 4:30 to 7:30, I believe, some light refreshments. And we still have Honeymoon Tonight by Patrice Helmar up on display, as well as the summer exhibit Get Your Motors Running, Chainsaws and Outboards, and that'll be through November 19th.
All right, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Thanks, Jeff.
Station from Z Avi. Time is 3:45 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Bob Kanitzer. He's a stone sculptor. He's the featured artist at this next month's Juneau Artist Gallery show. Bob, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
So what got you started sculpting in stone?
I lived in Ketchikan for 25 years, and I was a Northwest Coast carver, and met up with a guy on Prince of Wales Island named Gary McWilliams of Stone Arts of Alaska, and learned how to gather and sculpt stone from him.
Is he the one who taught you basically how to do what you do?
He taught me the basic tools and the techniques and things. I've been influenced by lots of other artists, Lou Cacioppo, a lot of people in Juneau know Lou, and worked with a lot of other Northwest Coast artists in Ketchikan.
Is there much of a learning curve?
Yeah. Stone's hard. And so you have to learn the proper tools and techniques as well as the artistic aspects of it. I'm not a great figurative sculptor. I do more abstracts and bowls and dishes and vessels and things like that. But stone, I used to complain about hand sanding a wood mask until I hand sanded my first stone mask. So it was about 30 hours worth of work.
Would you say stone is very forgiving?
Not really. Most of the stone, particularly the stone I work with, is from Prince of Wales Island, Dahl Island, Tuxican Island in southern southeast near Craig. And a lot of the limestone and marble there is fairly fractured, being close to the surface. So it's can be fairly fragile stone. And in that respect, a lot of it is not the classic. You don't use the classic hammer and chisels to remove the stone. You use more grinding tools to grind and polish the stone away. So you can have issues with breaking. It's harder to remove the stone, and you're certainly not putting it back. So it's not quite as forgiving as working with wood.
Have you ever been something like 90% of the way finished with a piece, and it just breaks on you?
Yep. And it's not a good thing.
What do you look for in a stone?
Color and pattern. Southern Southeast has just got some incredibly awesome stone as far as colors and patterns, and there's a lot of fossiliferous limestone there, a lot of clams, snails, stromatolites, sponges, corals, and combined with colors everywhere from, like the shirt you're wearing, Jeff, oranges and yellows to pastels and purples and greens and just really incredible stuff. And it's just really fun to have such a selection. It's not so much colored stone in the northern end of southeast here. I work with local granite here and a couple of other stones, but the stones from the southern southeast part are really incredible and pretty rare in some instances.
Must be hard moving it around.
Yeah, I used to be a little tougher than I am now. I could pick up 50, 60, 70-pound rocks and pack everything from the shore to the raft and to the boat and back to wherever it's going. My friend that I work with has permits from the Forest Service, and we go out and gather stone. And sometimes you have a truck and you're on a road, and sometimes you're out in the boat. Sometimes you're just walking down a beach. I have a yard completely filled with lots and lots of stone.
You have to have a permit to gather stones?
From the forest, yeah. From the Tongass National Forest, yeah.
Tell me about the process of sculpting a stone.
People do it different ways. Some artists will have a particular piece in mind and try and find something, stone, rock, wood, whatever it is, to sculpt. Others will have a piece of stone and it inspires something. Others, and this is kind of what I tend to do, I just start sculpting on the piece, start looking at the different angles and trying to see what is in there that wants to come out. And sometimes it works really well, and sometimes it doesn't, but it's just kind of a learning process. I've recently been reading a lot of sculpture books, looking at a lot of different modern sculptors and some of the masters. Just there's always inspiration in other people's work, and I find that gets me motivated to try new things.
What's the biggest and what's the smallest pieces you've worked on?
Smallest pieces are just, little polished rocks, a couple of inches. The biggest piece I've done, actually the biggest piece I've completed for myself is probably 30 inches by 12 inches by 20 inches. I've worked on some bigger pieces for my friend down on Prince of Wales Island that would be considered outdoor larger sculptures, but nothing bigger than 3 or 4 feet. It's especially I have a small studio at my house, so trying to move, I have to be able to, you know, they're called hand boulders, something that one or two people can handle or use a hand truck. I don't have room for a forklift in my driveway, and my wife won't agree to that, so I'll be stuck with the hand-sized sculptures for the time being.
Remind me again of the objects you sculpt.
I do lots of different, mainly my stuff at the gallery right now are vessels and bowls out of marble and limestone. Again, because the colors and the patterns are so incredible, simple shapes work really well because the stone is really busy, whereas if you have a plain colored stone, then you can do a more complex shape and it works better. Again, another thing I do with the local stone, that's, I call them candle lamps, granite candle lamps. We've all seen the really nice, rounded, glacial polished granite boulders that are all over the place, all the way from chicken egg size up to, you know, much larger. And I'll drill a hole in the top and put in either a candle or a little oil lamp. And, you know, people use them on their back decks or, you know, outside. They're kind of interesting pieces.
What tools do you use?
Variety of hand and power tools. I use lots of diamond bits, diamond Dremel grinding bits. Use a Makita angle grinder with a diamond blade on it a lot. That's probably one of my tools I use the most to remove lots of stone. I do use hand tools, you know, chisel and hammers for various things. Use lots of wet dry emery cloth for polishing, and I have diamond hand pads that I use to polish stone.
What's so special about stone for you?
It's pretty permanent. You know, it's interesting to think that, you know, pieces that I'll sculpt today, you know, could be around a couple hundred years from now. And, you know, I like carving in wood. I've done a lot of wood, but stone, something about it, just the permanence and the feel, and I don't know, just like it.
Do you think it's cheating to use power tools?
No, not at all. Anybody that ever sculpted would have used power tools if they didn't have them at the time. I mean, all artists are, you know, innovators. And like I say, the stone here just wouldn't allow it. You would just have a lot of wrecked stone. When you have beautiful, creamy, smooth Carrara, then it's more feasible to use hand tools. But there's definitely something calming about using the chip, chip, chip of using a hammer and a chisel. But power tools are nice. They give you lots of control, and you can get to where you're going a little bit faster.
I'm talking with Bob Kanitzer. He's got a solo show at the Juno Artist Gallery. He's one of the featured artists there this month, and they're having a First Friday exhibit. What's in the show for your First Friday show?
Sorry, what?
What's in your First Friday show?
Again, I have a variety of different pieces. I've finished three new pieces that haven't been put out yet. One is a larger bowl that has some black matrix. It has some really incredible fossils in it, fossil corals of different kinds. Another piece is made from a fossiliferous limestone that comes from Texarkana called Aphrodite marble that has purples and reds, and it has fossil clams and corals in it. And then the third piece is also it's a different kind of Aphrodite called golden Aphrodite that has more orange and yellowish hues in it. The two Aphrodite pieces are more platter shapes. The one's probably 26 inches by about 8 or 9 inches. So those will be out. And then I have a candle lamp there and several small to medium size bowls and soap dish kind of stones.
About how long does it take you to finish a typical piece?
Well, again, it depends on the size. It depends. Sometimes I buy the stone from Stone Arts already sliced into slabs, so that helps a lot. If you're just working with a raw, round chunk of stone, there's more time. But generally, anywhere from, you know, 8 hours to I don't know, 30, 40, 50 hours or more. I don't work continuously on pieces. That's the nice thing about art is you can work on it for an hour or two here or there and come back to it. Also, the stones need a lot of gluing because of the fractures in them. So working on 3 or 4 or 5 pieces at a time, I can kind of juggle things and always have a piece to work on.
All right, Bob Kanitzer, thank you very much for coming down to the station today to talk about your featured artist exhibit at the Juno Artist Gallery in the Senate Building. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Nope, thanks a lot, Jeff. We'll be there from 4 to 7 on Friday.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, through the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you, people call
say beware doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your neck. You know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with the mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling. As you stand to the vacuum of his eyes and say, do you want to make a deal?
It's 3:58, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, here KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Coming up tomorrow on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with Sarah DeLeo and Jessica Dempsey about Saga's 25th anniversary celebrations. Steve McPheeters and Father George Solides will be here to highlight the grand opening activities in the Holy Church of the Church of the Holy Trinity this weekend. We'll also find out about a free workshop on becoming a U.S. citizen with Heather Parker from the Learning Connection. We'll talk with organizers of the Art of Recovery exhibit opening Friday at the Silver Bow. And Nancy DeTourney will be here with news and views about local art during Arts Up. It's tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight, rain developing, possibly heavy at times, low temperatures around 49 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, more rain with high temperatures around 59 degrees. Thursday night, mostly cloudy skies with isolated showers in the evening, and the forecast for Friday looks like rain and high temperatures around 53 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau afternoon today, and have a pleasant evening. Take your diamond ring.